Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On the podcast Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Celebrating 13 awards, including Best Creativity Podcast. You'll learn from iconic creatives like Pixar director Domi Shi.
Go big, shoot for the sun, and then you can like land on the moon.
Actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I had to take responsibility for my own creativity.
And best-selling author Anne Patchett.
If you want to be better, you just have to keep doing it.
Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. In the early hours of Thursday, the 16th of February, these are our main stories. A white teenager has been sentenced to life without parole for shooting dead 10 black people in New York State. An Israeli firm has been accused of seeking to influence more than 30 elections around the world using hacking and disinformation. And unrest has broken out in Nigeria over a continuing shortage of cash caused by the government's policy of replacing old banknotes. Also in this podcast, the Hollywood star Raquel Welch has died at the age of 82.
She was born Jo Raquel Tejada, the daughter of a Bolivian engineer.
Now listen here, boy.
We'll hear more about her life and a career which spanned over five decades. A court in the United States has sentenced a white teenager to life in prison without parole for killing 10 black people at a supermarket in Buffalo, in New York State, last May. Investigators discovered Peyton Gendron had researched the racial makeup of the neighborhood online before the massacre. At the sentencing, angry relatives of victims confronted the teenager. One man even charged towards him. Judge Susan Egan told him he would receive no clemency.
There can be no mercy for you, no understanding, no second chances. The damage you have caused is too great, and the people you have hurt are too valuable to this community. You will never see the light of day as a free man ever again. It is the judgment of this court for your conviction under the first count of the indictment, a domestic act of terrorism motivated by hate in the first degree, an A1 felony, that you be sentenced to life imprisonment without parole.
From Buffalo, Neda Taufik reports.
This was a hearing that was emotional really throughout. I mean, the judge refused to sentence him as a youth. He was 18 at the time because of how horrendous this crime was. The fact that he researched, planned this, surveyed the Tops grocery store in this black neighborhood, led reconnaissance, and then executed this attack. Remember the heinousness of this. He live streamed this shooting on Twitch, the social media platform, after being inspired online by other white supremacists. And so in this hearing, we knew he would be sentenced to life without parole. That was the mandatory sentence for a domestic terrorism motivated by hate charge. But what this did was give the family members an opportunity to confront him. And they were incredibly emotional. It was clear, as they said themselves, that they are still grieving this attack and the loss of their loved ones. And many confronted him, calling him a coward, racist, saying that he didn't understand anything about the black community. And even after he apologized, members of the courtroom saying that they didn't believe he was remorseful. The district attorney saying he didn't think that apology was heartfelt because Peyton Gendron is still facing several federal charges. And with those charges, he could face the death penalty.
That was Neda Taufik. An Israeli firm has been accused of seeking to influence more than 30 elections around the world using hacking, sabotage, and by spreading disinformation on social media. The report, a result of an undercover media investigation, is being seen as further proof of how shadowy private companies profit from invasive hacking and seek to manipulate public opinion through social media. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Now.
Working from an office in Modain near Tel Aviv, the business is headed by Tal Hanan, a former Israeli Special Forces operative. He appears to have been working under the radar in various countries for more than two decades, offering what's known in the industry as black ops services to intelligence agencies, private firms, and election campaigns. Over months, an international team of journalists posed as potential clients. Mr. Hanan boasted of being able to control supposedly secure Telegram accounts and thousands of fake social media profiles, as well as planting news stories, according to reports. He said most of his campaigns were in Africa, while also mentioning teams in Greece and the United Arab Emirates. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which was part of the investigation, Mr. Hanan's contractors were the previously unnamed Israeli hackers mentioned in reports on the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal. Mr. Hanan has denied any wrongdoing.
Yoland Now. Thousands of Syrian war refugees who fled to Turkey have lined border crossings, intent on going back to Syria after last week's earthquakes. It follows reports that Turkey will relax immigration rules, allowing them to leave for 3 to 6 months and then return. If confirmed, this would be a major policy change by Ankara. Home to more than 4 million Syrian refugees, Turkey has greatly tightened its border controls over recent years. Our correspondent Laura Bicker has been to one of the border crossings, but her report starts with continued rescue efforts in Turkey, where more people were miraculously pulled from the rubble on Tuesday.
Every day in Antakya, relatives huddle around piles of rubble that were once family homes, waiting for news. But rescue efforts have slowly become recovery missions. And now, as workers comb through bricks and dust, the hope is of finding a body to say a final farewell. 30 people are entombed in what is left of this building. Layers of concrete are pulled apart to reveal the remains of someone's living room. 5 of Hava Ecker's family lived here.
All of those people died while screaming, "Save us! Save us!" There was no one. Human life has no value in Turkey.
There are some who are still defying the odds. After more than 200 hours, two women were pulled from deep within the ruins. At least 3 others were rescued in other parts of Turkey, but there are fewer medical moments each day. And for survivors, living in fractured cities where damaged buildings are still collapsing, coping with freezing temperatures with no heating, little water and food, is becoming more difficult by the day.
They're asking for wet wipes, soaps, shampoos. There's water, but there's nowhere to take a shower. People are struggling.
President Erdogan has denied accusations that his administration's response to this disaster was slow. The wait for aid has been longer in Syria, but more is now on its way.
Until today, this was the only route available for aid to get through to Syria. But the United Nations has now organised 2 other border crossings. But it leaves key questions. First, will this be enough to help the millions who are now thought to be homeless? And second, if this had happened earlier, could more lives have been saved?
The search for survivors in Idlib is over. The living are now focused on staying warm and alive. This has been one of the world's deadliest earthquakes, but without urgent help, this disaster could claim even more lives.
That was Laura Bicker. The war in Ukraine has unsurprisingly seen little to no diplomacy between Kyiv and Moscow. One area of cooperation has been around prisoner of war exchanges. More than 1,700 Ukrainian men and women have reportedly made it home through them so far. The BBC has been given rare access to one facility where captured Russian soldiers are held in the west of the country. Kyiv says most of the prisoners will be swapped, but some will be held on suspicion of possible war crimes. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse has sent this report.
How is this for a picture? We've come down to a bomb shelter. The door has opened and there are around 20 Russian prisoners of war in their blue uniforms taking shelter from Russian missiles. The Ukrainian officers here are letting us pick out who we want to speak to, but it's unlikely many will feel able to speak freely.
One tells us he surrendered near the eastern town of Solidar last month. Several say they just want to go home. Ukraine needs these captured troops to trade for their own. And after credible reports of prisoner abuses on both sides, Kyiv insists these men are being treated fairly.
We've walked into another shelter and you're met with quite a pungent smell. When you speak to the men, some look pretty defeated, ashen-faced. Some are visibly old and others have a bit more of a glint in their eye. They're keen to interact some more.
Most prisoners are required to work 6 days a week, including in this furniture assembly workshop. They earn a wage from it, though not much. I asked the guard what it's like standing next to soldiers who invaded his country. That's a very provocative question, he replies, but it's our job, he adds. He declines to elaborate. History tends to have an echo. This austere prison was once used to house captured soldiers in the Second World War.
There's coiled barbed wire running along battered walls. The path is icy, and on the left here are pictures of ancient Ukrainian rulers next to a Ukrainian flag. There's no mistaking the messaging inside this prisoner of war camp.
Whether it's picking ice off the paving or marching two by two to the canteen, there seems to be an established routine here. It appears the only interruption to the monotony are the air raid alerts, the second one today. On the day we visit, the men are served corn soup, meat and barley and a hunk of bread. It's a muted meal, and in a perfect act of choreography afterwards, they stand and shout thank you for their lunch in Ukrainian. In another block, inmates queue to use the phone. They're allowed a call home every 2 weeks, so we're told. As a guard stands over them, their conversations are recorded.
Hello?
Hello, привет, мам.
Ой, сынок, привет.
Как у тебя дела?
Where are you, asks this man's mum. I'm in captivity, I can't say more. With the bloody Ukrainians, she asks, before breaking down in tears. Enough, mum, he replies. The most important thing is that I'm alive and healthy. Another inmate wasn't so successful. He's met with a busy signal. The guard asks whether he has another number. No, he mumbles, and is led away. Some of these prisoners will be held under investigation for war crimes. Most will be exchanged. They're a kind of currency in this growing wartime economy.
That was James Waterhouse. Here in Britain, a woman who faked a medical degree certificate and who managed to falsely pass herself off as a psychiatrist for 2 decades has been told to expect to serve jail time for fraud. Jolia Alemi's professional deception was uncovered by a journalist. He, Phil Coleman of the News and Star in Cumbria, investigated her background with the General Medical Council after she was convicted of forging the will of an elderly lady she had befriended. He told Evan Davis what happened.
I had a simple strategy. The plan was, OK, let's do some further checks. Let's dig deeper. And in pursuance of that, I went all the way back to the beginning of Alemi's career. Now, she qualified, according to the GMC register, in New Zealand. She acquired a medical degree at the University of Auckland, so said the GMC register. And I thought it was worth checking. I didn't think this would produce a result, but it was worth checking with the University of Auckland to see whether she actually did qualify. And you can imagine my surprise when, in response to my query, the New Zealand equivalent of the GMC confirmed that she had, in fact, never qualified as a doctor, which meant that for 22 years, Zolia Alemi, who did legitimately, on the face of it, achieve consultant status by passing the necessary exams, for 22 years, she'd been practicing as a doctor when, in fact, she was not qualified as a doctor.
And Phil, she would have been prescribing drugs, not just talking therapies in that period.
Well, absolutely. There was a pattern to Alemi's career. Her mode of working, it seemed, was to work as a locum and then move on fairly swiftly. But I've said many times in discussing this case that I think there's probably no profession that gives more power and authority over other people's lives than the profession of a doctor, and particularly a psychiatrist. She could prescribe powerful antipsychotic drugs. She could have people detained for treatment against their will. So, yeah, she had a huge amount of influence and a huge amount of power as a doctor.
In this case, Phil, has there been much testimony from former patients who were, you know, put in front of her?
Good question. And it's certainly a question I asked. The case that's just finished at Manchester Crown Court focused on whether or not the qualifications provided to the GMC in 1995 were genuine or not. And there was irrefutable evidence that Alemi forged those documents. Obvious mistakes, spelling mistakes on a degree certificate, for goodness sake.
Extraordinary.
But yeah, patients. I did track down a few patients. One was a young lady from Scotland. She was a teenager when Alemi took charge of her case. And she told me one or two concerning stories about what she felt were very unprofessional approaches from Alemi. Alemi, for example, would tell her personal stories about her life and about her family. Not quite the professional relationship you'd expect from a psychiatrist.
Phil Coleman of the News and Star in Cumbria. Still to come on this podcast.
America is not past our prime. It's just that our politicians are past theirs.
At her first rally of her campaign, the former governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, emphasizing youth in her bid to win the Republican presidential nomination. Next to Nigeria. Protests have been taking place in several cities across the south of the country over the introduction of new banknotes. Banks have been attacked and cash machines looted due to the challenges of getting hold of the newly circulated currency, which is replacing the old Naira notes. The unrest comes just over a week before presidential elections. Chris Ewokor is our correspondent in the capital, Abuja.
The Central Bank of Nigeria had pushed the policy to scrap the use of banknotes and then gave a deadline that was to end in January 31st. But after much pressure, the deadline was pushed forward to February 10. However, some state governors took the federal government to court, urging that the policy should either be scrapped or actually be redesigned to allow both the old and the new banknotes to circulate side by side for some time. However, there was a court ruling today adjourning the case to Wednesday next week. And perhaps this is what could have triggered the anger of many people, because they had expected a clear pronouncement to show that either the policy was going to continue or end.
Why was it considered necessary by the authorities to bring in the new notes? What were they trying to actually achieve for Nigerians?
Well, when the Central Bank of Nigeria announced in October last year that it was going to redesign the three big notes, there were some reasons it gave. One of it was that there was so much cash in circulation, and many of them outside the banking circle, and this is causing a lot of inflation in the country. The other one basically was also to help in, you know, monitoring how money flows, how cash flows, because of this issue of insecurity. Kidnapping for ransom is very high here in Nigeria. And people are suggesting that the central bank could use tracking of Naira notes, getting those kidnappers or their sponsors. So one of the reasons is to come up with new notes that can be easily tracked. The other reason is basically it's unspoken, but economists say that it is intended to curb vote buying.
Okay, so just talk us through what the impact has been on Nigerians of all of this uncertainty.
For the past 3 weeks, many Nigerians have experienced queues at banking halls and cash dispensing points across the country. And many people have been frustrated because they've been asked to deposit their old notes at the bank. But again, they don't have access. I mean, they can't access new notes. Many banks are not giving out new notes. Many people also fear that the impact of these could affect the conduct of the election coming up next week, Saturday.
Chris Ewoko in Abuja. Now, as we reported on yesterday's podcast, the former Republican governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, has announced that she will run to become president of the United States. Ms. Haley, who is also the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has outlined the main themes of her bid to win the Republican nomination for the presidency at her first campaign event. Here's our Washington correspondent, Anthony Zerker.
The future president of the United States, Nikki Haley.
On Wednesday, Nikki Haley kicked off her campaign for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination at a rally in Charleston, South Carolina.
America is not past our prime. It's just that our politicians are past theirs.
The former South Carolina governor becomes the first person to take on Donald Trump, but she won't be the last. Facing the possibility of a crowded field, Ms. Haley's challenge is to find a pathway to the presidency.
Dave Wilson, nice to meet you. Let's go on inside.
Dave Wilson, a local evangelical Christian leader and president of the Palmetto Family Council, says opponents underestimate Ms. Haley at their own peril.
Few people understand how well Nikki Haley does retail politics. When the biker clubs said, hey, listen, would you come speak to us? She'd put on a pair of jeans and a pair of boots and go to the biker bar and sit there and talk with them.
Ms. Haley has never faced anyone quite like Donald Trump, though. He was her boss when she was U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and now she's after his old job.
I will not be surprised if Donald Trump has a nickname for her already. That's going to backfire. Nikki won't put up with that.
Some people look at America and see vulnerability.
Nicknames and relentless attacks helped propel Mr. Trump to the presidency back in 2016. But Nikki Haley's video response to how she would deal with bullies in Russia and China might equally apply to her Republican opponent.
I don't put up with bullies. And when you kick back, it hurts them more if you're wearing heels.
Current polling and conversation with Republican voters suggests they may be looking for someone different. Someone who may support the former president's policies without his baggage. The big question, however, is Nikki Haley the candidate to do it? What does a Nikki Haley voter look like?
I think a Nikki Haley voter very well may be a soccer mom in the suburbs.
That's Dallas Woodhouse, president of the South Carolina Policy Council, a conservative think tank. Ms. Haley has a well-rounded resume, both at the state level and in the Trump White House. But Mr. Woodhouse says she runs the risk of being caught in a middle ground between Mr. Trump and the alternatives.
I think that is a tightrope. She's going to have to show some tremendous political skill, but she stepped into the major leagues with this announcement, and we'll see if she can do it.
Well, would you like to sign?
What brings you out to see Nikki Haley today?
I think we need a new candidate, and I think that we need a female in there to tell these men how to do things just the right way.
So Nikki Haley has made her opening pitch. She's in for a dogfight here in South Carolina and across all the early voting states next year. If she prevails, it will be because Republican voters want something different and because her experience, background, and political skills separated her from what is expected to be a very crowded pack.
That was Anthony Zerker. Now, in the earlier edition of the Global News podcast, we brought you the news that a key figure in British politics, Nicola Sturgeon, is resigning as First Minister of Scotland after 8 years. She has been a member of the Scottish Parliament since it opened in 1999 and its longest-serving First Minister. She has, of course, also been a thorn in the sides of successive British prime ministers. But in a wide-ranging speech which referred to how brutal politics can be, she said that part of serving well is to know almost instinctively when the time is right to make way for someone else. She said that in her head and heart she knew the time was now. Let's remind you of some of the key points of her career at the top of Scottish politics.
This is a special and a very proud moment for me, a working class girl from Ayrshire, given the job of heading up the Government of Scotland. You know, this is shaping up to be an outstandingly good night for the SNP. The tectonic plates of Scottish politics have clearly shifted. You know, Scotland has sent a very clear message. We don't want a Boris Johnson Conservative government. We don't want to leave the European Union. And we want Scotland's future to be in Scotland's hands.
Our correspondent James Naughtie looks at what impact she's had on Scottish politics.
She and her predecessor as First Minister, Alex Salmond, who was the man who inspired her as a teenager with the nationalist idea, brought her into the party. Between the two of them have dominated Scottish politics since he became First Minister in 2007. And that means that they've had an enormous impact on UK politics. Because the constitutional argument and the constitution of the UK is in flux, it's on the move, today's events don't change that, have been hugely influenced by the SNP's extraordinary electoral success, which you've just described and alluded to. I think that the real lesson of today for the SNP is that they have to find a way of doing what she said, finding a leader who will reach across to those voters who are undecided. But it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult for two reasons. One, that hers are very difficult shoes to fill. Her skills as a politician, her effortless command and clarity, you look at her performance during the COVID pandemic, that was very clear, is very hard to replicate. And secondly, she is acknowledging, although she sought to deny it there in one little phrase, that the move to independence that she thought was beginning to take off after the defeat in the 24 referendum simply hasn't gone the way she thought it would. She thought that the Brexit vote, when Britain voted to leave the European Union in 2016, would give new propulsion to the independence move. It hasn't. The truth is that public opinion, some surveys go up, some go down, but public opinion in general has not moved very much since 2014. So even Nicola Sturgeon, with all her formidable political skills, hasn't been able to produce a decisive, settled majority for Scottish independence. It's going to be very, very hard for any successor to do it.
That was James Naughtie. Engineers working on the first ever satellite mission from the UK say it failed because of a faulty fuel filter. The Virgin Orbit rocket was supposed to take 9 spacecraft high above the Earth, but instead ditched in the Atlantic Ocean. Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, explains what went wrong.
Godspeed, Launcher One. Godspeed, Cosmic Girl, on this historic both European and UK mission.
To much fanfare and in front of thousands of spectators, a jumbo jet left Cornwall's Newquay Airport in January to try to launch 9 satellites to space, a first from UK soil. The jumbo, belonging to Sir Richard Branson, was carrying a rocket under its left wing. When the plane reached the Irish coast, it turned and pointed south, releasing the rocket to head skyward. For several minutes, everything seemed fine, but then communication was lost. The investigation has pointed to a fuel filter that became dislodged in the rocket's upper stage engine, causing it to overheat and eventually shut down. Any debris that survived the heat of re-entry is now at the bottom of the Atlantic. Virgin Orbit promises to learn from the experience and return to flight soon. It needs to. Sir Richard's US-based company is in competition with other rocket operators and must conduct regular and successful launches to start turning a profit.
Jonathan Amos. The Hollywood star Raquel Welch has died at the age of 82 after a brief illness. She appeared in dozens of films and TV series over decades and became an international sex symbol after wearing a fur bikini in one role. David Sillitoe looks back at her life.
Raquel Welch did not expect anyone to remember what she thought was just a silly dinosaur movie.
See the fascinating, strange and fearful creatures who roamed and ruled the Earth a million years B.C.
But 1 million years B.C., with its giant malevolent turtles, poor grasp of evolution, and prehistoric bikinis turned Raquel Welch into a star. In one fell swoop, everything about the real me was, she said, swept away. It was pretty clear how she was being marketed, but she said she had little control over her career.
Now listen here, boys. I used to be a square.
She was born Jo Raquel Tejada, the daughter of a Bolivian engineer, and her heart really lay in song and dance. Light-hearted, old-school glamour.
Singapore Sally, life gave her quieter.
The producer behind many of her projects was the man she married in 1967, film producer Patrick Curtis. It would be fair to say she was better known than many of her films. But she did win a Golden Globe for The Three Musketeers.
Never again will I let you go into such terrible danger.
And on stage and television, she did get a chance to show off her song and dance skills.
That was David Sillitoe on the life of Raquel Welch. She has died aged 82. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. But before we go, I have been known occasionally to be a little bit facetious, and that regrettable tendency led to an email to verify whether Charlotte Gallagher is actually a member of the royal family. Charlotte Gallagher, are you actually a member of the royal family?
I'm really flattered by the suggestion, because I say bath instead of bath and grass instead of grass, but I am not a member of the royal family.
Thank you for clearing that up. And if you want to comment, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley. It was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard. And until next time, goodbye.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, actor Asif Manvi.
Indian people did not go to the theater to see themselves.
Asif shares the story of writing the one-person play, Sakina's Restaurant.
What do you mean there's a play about me and my experience?
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.